Welcome to Car Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm your host, Scott Benjamin.
And I am also your host, Ben Bolin. We are not alone. We are joined, of course, with our good friend,
Kurt Guerin. Hello, everyone.
Holy smokes, Scott. Scott Benjamin, is it good to see you, man?
Well,
you're back.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. It's good to be back. You kept the seat warm.
We kept the seat warm. We had a number of strange adventures. You know, Kurt and I are always getting into some weird conversations. We learned about the Tesla Cybertruck, which would love to hear your thoughts on one day. We did a piece on the evolution of the El Camino. Remember that one?
That was a good one.
Oh, yeah. Like El Caminos.
You know, the thing that we got caught on was that the name of that translates to just the road.
it's not too inspiring, is it, really? I mean, maybe a little bit, but it's good to be back anyway. I really appreciate it, and thank you guys for keeping the show afloat here while I was gone. I really do thank you for that, and just a quick explanation. I just took some time off to kind of get things pulled together in my own personal life. You know, that Insomniac show that I've been working on, that... I almost said the word. That stuff is real. I wasn't kidding around. That really messed with my sleep, messed with my whole life, you know, from in here and outside of work, and it was a disaster. And I just took some time off to kind of pull some things together and get back in the right mindset to do this show and be clear and, you know, a lot more present here with you guys. And I'm really excited about getting back into Car Stuff and just making it the best show that we can. I'm really, really happy to be back behind the mic.
Likewise, you know, the powers that be would not have let me back onto the show if circumstances have been different. I kind of snuck back in here. Well, you know how I am.
Well, that's a bit of a reunion for us, right? I mean, yeah. You know, before it was Kurt and I, and that was great. But then when I'm back here, it's like it feels comfortable again. It's like we never stopped doing the show. That was years ago now. It was a long, long time ago when we stopped doing that show together. But here we are again. We got Kurt joining us, who is fantastic, and we're all in this tiny little room staring at each other. There might be some awkward silence. You never know. We'll see what happens. But it's. I think it's a good team. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with this.
Well said. Well said, Scott.
Indeed.
So today's episode is fascinating because as you had established, you know, you, Kurt, and I have been doing some variety or some version or iteration of this show for the better part of a decade. And for a peek behind the curtain, folks, longtime listeners, you'll know this, or anyone with your own podcast. After about year five or six on some shows, you start saying, you start forgetting what you had covered, you know, in previous episodes.
Oh, sure.
And wondering what you're going to do. And Kurt, you recently, you had a fantastic idea. It was such a good idea that I was convinced we had covered it before at some point in the past 9+ years. And I was wrong. We had never covered it, which baffles me. I think it baffled you too, Scott.
It did.
Surprising, yeah. So we decided that we would cover sled dog races, most notably the Iditarod in Alaska.
Yeah. Now, some people are going to say, what the heck? This is Car Stuff, right? But if you remember Car Stuff of the past, we have always covered just about any form of transportation, just about everything, really. And funny thing is, that can even be spun off into other things. Like I remembered yesterday, we've even done like the Pinewood Derby cars, you know, the Pinewood Derby races.
Everything that floats, flies, swims, or drives.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, every form of transportation, and I think this is the perfect time of year to talk about, you know, something like this, you know, some way of getting around that maybe not everybody is familiar with, but it's really fascinating. I mean, when you dig into it and how into, you know, the sleds these people get into, the dog teams, of course, they get. Just the whole lifestyle that goes along with this, the history of it, it's all very rich, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's also one of those races, one of those events that takes us to the limits of what our bodies can, like, endure. And it takes us to the limits of what we would call civilization. You're very much in the frontier. Have either of you ever been to Alaska?
I have.
You have?
Yes.
Okay. Where'd you go?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not you know, the wilderness experience that you might think. I took an Alaskan cruise many years ago. This is probably 7 years ago.
That's right. I remember.
And we did talk about this on air. And you know, it goes to the usual ports. It was a celebrity brand cruise. We're not getting paid. Don't worry. But celebrity brand cruise. So that tells you the ports that we went to. And I can't remember all of them, but it was like Ketchikan. I can't even. Skagway was one, I know, because I'll tell you this. When we went to Skagway, and we did go a little further north too, but we went to Skagway, and one of the excursions that you could take, and we did do this one, was to go to a dog sled training camp. And I did that, and we talked about that, and it was fascinating. It was maybe a 45-minute or an hour bus ride to get to this thing. You're seeing things like bald eagles on the way, and, you know, it's just pristine, beautiful Alaskan countryside, you know, a little mountainous, you know, lots of trees and things like that. And it wasn't like a blizzard or anything like that. It was their off season. So they're in training camp, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get the opportunity to go and sit in a training dog sled and have them haul you for a 1 mile trek around this mountain course that they have. And maybe, should I hold on to this for later, or do you want to talk about it right now? It's pretty quick.
Hey, lay it on us,
okay,
man.
So at the time, if you remember when I got back from this, I was so fired up about this because it's almost like, if you can picture a golf cart, like an elongated golf cart, so it's on wheels, obviously, it's not on skis, and it has a kind of a runner in front, like a bump guard maybe or something like that. It holds six people sitting. There's seats kind of built into this thing. It's an aluminum frame, I believe, or metal frame. And then the musher would stand on the back, and they have a dog team in front of you that's pulling, and they pull in this kind of mountainous, rocky road, right? And I'm sitting in this cart with, you know, all these other tourists from the boat, and we're not small people. You know, we're adults. My daughter was with us. She was small. But everybody else is adults, even the musher. So seven people. When those dogs took off, I mean, it slammed me back in the seat. It was a forceful takeoff, and they pulled and pulled and pulled, and you thought they were never going to stop. And the funny thing is, like, these dogs were, I mean, they were jacked about pulling that sled. They loved it. And you would think, no, there's no way. There's no, you know, this has got to be cruel in some way, which we'll get to that, because there are people that think that, right?
Right.
You see these dogs, they are, and I know it's hard to believe, but they're genuinely excited about pulling that sled. And I think I didn't understand it until I was there and felt it in person, saw it in person, witnessed all this. And it was really cool day. It was like $100 at the time. It's more now to do this excursion. But it was so worth it. It was so much fun and just a real eye-opening experience. It gave you a little bit of history, gave you some of the, you could stand on an actual dog sled that they had retired, you know, a wooden one, and check that out. It was really cool, all the parts of it. And it gave you a greater appreciation for what the sport is about, the history of it, the truth behind it, really.
Right. Yeah. This is the thing. So I just went to Alaska earlier this year for the first time in my life. I was there for about 10 days. I wasn't too far out in the wilderness, but I was captivated by how close to the wild people are. Like, it doesn't even matter. The biggest city in Alaska is still going to have moose that run the town, because moose are just huge. I would not be surprised if there's a moose in downtown Anchorage that has like a mortgage business or something, you know? So I was amazed by how close to wild we are. And this even goes into the rules of the Iditarod, which we'll discuss in a little bit. Let's first separate two important things here. Although the race is often called the Iditarod, right? There is it goes on a route for the majority of the time that follows a trail, the Iditarod Trail, which is a different thing, and it's very old. It was used for centuries before the first Europeans arrived to use it, and the first people who identified and used this trail from the European side of the ocean were Russian fur traders way back in the 1800s. Native people in Alaska or First Nations would use this this trail system, right, to travel to different villages. And eventually it became one of those things like a desire path. It was just the best route from point A to point B to point C and so on. And so in 1908, government employees cleared the Iditarod Trail, which made it a little easier to navigate. But in 1910, someone found gold. And that changes everything.
In the town of Iditarod, right?
In the town of Iditarod.
Yeah, okay. Well, that did change everything because, you know, that town, I guess, kind of blew up overnight, right? They became boom towns. And there were a lot of these in Alaska, as we all know, just from our history classes in, you know, elementary school. You kind of learn about the gold rushes and what was going on there. But what happened is then a lot of the what do they call them, veins, I guess, of gold?
True.
They dry up. You know, they go away. You know, gold is no longer found. It's not profitable to do that. The town kind of dries up along the way with it. The town remains. It remains maybe, you know, a shell of itself. It remains kind of a skeleton of itself and becomes eventually a ghost town if it's allowed to go that far. Some of them just kind of remain with a few residents here and there. But you know what? Since we're talking about towns,
yeah,
we kind of glossed over your trip to Alaska. What towns did you go to? Any of the towns that might have been on the trail, or were you a cruise passenger as well?
No, mainly Anchorage, and I had to send a team to Cordoba, and then they also went to Hitchinbrook Island, and then I traveled up to Willow, Alaska.
Did you say you had to send a team?
Uh-huh.
Okay. This is interesting. I didn't even know you went to Alaska, so I'll have to ask you about this later.
A lot of water under the bridge, man. A lot of stuff happened.
It's like
a lot
like
of stuff happened.
He's like an undercover. It's like a Navy SEAL or something. SEAL Team 5 somewhere.
Oh, man. You know, I got to say, like, maybe it's a story for another day. But, yeah, the boom and bust that you're talking about is very real, and it's happened around the world. When a town rises up based on a single resource, it is therefore dependent on that resource. If the coal dries up, then a coal town dies, right? And sure. Same with gold.
Before the gold actually dried up, the Guggenheims bought up a bunch of the smaller scale mines in the area around Flat and Iditarod. And they introduced a little bit more of like a mechanized, large-scale way of mining. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take as many individuals, like sitting there, you know, trying to strike gold in various places. So it kind of took away the need for mail deliveries and food deliveries and travel along the trails in between. So the gold may have dried up later, but before that happened, like kind of like a large, I guess, company or conglomerate came in and started doing all the mining. So it needed less individuals.
So what's interesting is they had less individuals, and it took away the need for food and the need for all that for many, many people. That means that they never were quite established to the point they could have been. They didn't get the roadway systems that they would have had. They didn't get you know, the infrastructure that we would normally think of associate with a larger town, a small airport even.
Well, a lot of things were happening. Railroads, for example, around this time were kind of starting to be built in Alaska. So I think human travel along the trail is just kind of, a lot of different things happen at once to make this perfect storm. If you don't use these trails, they just go into disrepair, sort of. That's what keeps them there, you know, the frequent travel.
Yeah.
This is exactly what happened at the Bates Hotel, and that's exactly why that, you know, could lead to bad things.
It's true.
Yeah. Bates Hotel, we all know that, right?
The Iditarod of horror films.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what Hitchcock called it. One question we have to address here at the top, before we get in the nuts and the bolts of the race itself, we need to explore the role of dog teams in general in this part of the world. Nowadays, we're very fortunate. There are airplanes all over the place. There are tons and tons of Cessnas in Alaska, right? And they make small, you know, like puddle jumper flights.
Oh, sure.
Because it's the best way to access point A to point B in some cases. Before, there were airplanes delivering mail and supplies and so on to very remote areas of Alaska. People used dog teams. It was the best way to transport yourself and goods, you know, game, food, water, so on. And many people lived a subsistence lifestyle where, you know, you were so familiar with your dog team, it was like your daily driver.
Just like horses would have been back then in areas further south.
No, sure. And you take care of them extremely well because that's your only way to get around. They're extremely valuable to you, right? I mean, they're like gold in themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want anything to happen to your dog team. You don't want anything to happen to your horse team, of course. Mm-hmm. They become like family members, really, a lot of them, I would bet. I mean,
yeah.
It's not like they're not just work animals. They're also part of the family.
Similar to your cars.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
You okay. Yeah. Have to take care of it.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the car, Kurt.
Yeah. You know,
you grow out of favor with more quickly than others, right? But this is a critical part here, right? Because we're talking about delivery of goods and services, or, well, I guess goods, via dog sled. So, you know, what can you take? You can only take small items, really.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when there's maybe an emergency?
Ah, excellent question, Scott. It's almost as if you're setting me up for something.
No.
It's true. And this leads us directly to the story of the race that we call the Iditarod today, also called the Last Great Race on Earth.
Mm.
Well, that's from Iditarod.com. They're a little biased.
Well, sure.
So in 1925, there were 20 mushers. Have we even talked? You mentioned musher. What's a musher?
A musher is the person driving the sled.
Okay.
Riding the sled, I guess. I don't know. Driving? Riding?
Piloting?
A pilot? Yeah, maybe piloting. Are... Captaining?
Yeah, captain. He kind of shouts the commands to the dog.
Yeah.
Well, they're mushing. Yeah. It's mushing. You're mushing.
Mushing.
Yeah. Mushers mush.
So in 1925, a team of 20 mushers commanding about 150 sled dogs had to travel 674 miles. That's 1,085 kilometers for everybody outside of the U.S. and like two other countries. And they traveled this tremendous distance in 5.5 days, and they were on a mission, like some real superhero stuff. What were they doing?
They were delivering a serum to cure a diphtheria outbreak that they were having in Nome at the time.
Oh, so they're going from wherever the I think initially wasn't there. There was a plane, I think, that took the initial serum, right? To a certain
train.
A train took the first little bit. Yeah, and then the train could no longer go the rest of the distance. Mm-hmm. So the dogs were able to accommodate that. And, of course, we said there were, 20 mushers, so that means 20 dog teams.
It's a relay.
Yeah, like a big relay race. You're right. It's like, you know, hand off the serum, get it on its way. Hand off the serum, get it on the way. And the reason they needed the serum, I don't know if we even said this, it was diphtheria.
Right. There was a diphtheria outbreak in Nome and the surrounding smaller communities, and it was an epidemic. There's mm-hmm. no two ways about it. The authorities in Nome realized that the diphtheria antitoxin they did have was bad. It was expired. It was a bum antitoxin. And expect it to have efficacy. So they needed this stuff in a hurry, and that's why there's a relay, because the dogs are still fresh, right? Mm-hmm. And so they can pass it off to one another. This became known, spoiler alert, they successfully completed the run. The diphtheria antitoxin was delivered. The town was saved. This is now known sometimes as the Great Race of Mercy or the Serum Run. And these people and their dogs became heroes. They were celebrities overnight.
So much so that, okay, we got to remember this too, that we're talking about, we know where Alaska is, right? How far away Alaska is from New York.
Yes.
Okay. There is a statue in Central Park in New York City of one of the dogs that they consider to be like the hero dog. It's the lead dog that finally brought the serum into Nome, right? Mm-hmm. It's the last dog. His name is Balto.
Balto.
Balto the dog. And you can go see Balto the dog statue in Central Park. And you have seen it, right, Ben?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so it's
still
there. Still there. And you know, a lot of people had, there was a little bit of controversy over Balto, if you can believe this or not. I mean, the musher, of course, I don't even remember the guy's name right now, but he's also a hero. But there was a particular dog and musher that they thought should have been given all this credit because it was the one that took the most difficult leg of the journey. And I don't recall from what town to what town that was. I read that yesterday, and I should have written it down, but I didn't. So it's there was somewhat of a controversy between Balto and this other dog, because this dog just simply was the last one. There were 20 along the way that probably deserve equal credit.
Yeah. The one you're referring to is a dog named Togo.
Oh, okay.
Ooh. And he was the lead dog for Leonard Cipolla, who competed in a race that they had, a sled dog race that they had in Alaska pre-World War One.
Whoa. Okay.
So he won it the last four times that they did this race. It was called the All Alaska Sweepstakes.
I'm going to give some background real quick on what Sapal and Togo did. They did cover, as you guys said, the most hazardous leg of the journey. They made a round trip of 261 miles from Nome to Shaktulik and then back to Golovin. And this means they delivered the serum a total of 91 miles, which is almost double the distance that any other team did.
Ah, okay. So they really, they put it out there. They delivered.
Balto just had a better PR team, I guess.
Yeah, they got to, they were the ones that...
They got the finish line, right?
Yeah.
Isn't there a saying? I mean, it's probably a bumper sticker, but, you know, unless you're the lead dog, the view never changes.
Oh, that's wow. Did you write that?
No.
That's pretty good.
No. Well, it's kind of funny, too, if you think about it.
It also makes me think that unless you're the lead dog, you're always looking at another dog's butt.
That's what I mean. Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. That's the way I always take it. But I think it's got a deeper meaning as well, I believe, you know.
A less butt-centric meaning. There's also a statue of Balto in downtown Anchorage.
Can I stop you for a second?
Yeah.
Since we're talking about this, I just have to say this.
Yeah.
One of the most shocking parts of the trip that the 1 mile trip that I was on
the dog sled training camp,
is that while we're this is so gross, and don't let this discourage you from doing this if you get a chance.
Oh boy,
the dogs they crap while they run. They don't stop. So, like, they don't wait until it's rest time to go off in the woods and go. They go while they're running. And,
like horses.
And it gets flipped up, and you don't realize it, right, as a passenger until you're done. And then you're like, what is that? So, you know, you may or may not experience this. I don't know. It kind of depends on, you know, what happens when.
Yeah.
But these dogs, like, they just go as they're, like, full speed ahead. And, of course, it gets thrown all over you.
Nobody talked about that.
It's a shocking moment. My kid was just upset about that.
Did she get hit with it?
I also was upset. It's not like, it's like the, oh, this is so gross. It's just like... It's like as if somebody was riding a bicycle in front of you and, you know, mud gets flipped up on you or something. It's like little drops of mud and rocks and things like that get thrown up.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you realize later, like, oh, wait a minute. Some of that's dog crap.
That's great.
Yeah, so just beware, but don't let that discourage you. Okay.
That's incredible insight.
I'm glad, you know, I'm shocked I didn't think of that, Kurt. Did you?
Hadn't dawned on me.
It is something. It
makes
really sense.
Well, I'm not going to tell my girlfriend until we're on the sled.
No, you know, and again, maybe just bring some goggles.
Great.
So, all right, I interrupted. I'm sorry,
that's perfect. Yeah. And that's valuable information for anybody who's planning on going sledding after hearing this story. So we said there were two different kind of competing stories, right? Many people will claim that the Nome Run from 1925 is the inspiration for the Iditarod that happens annually today. We do want to say one other thing about the Nome Run. It helped inspire an inoculation campaign throughout the U.S. for diphtheria.
Positive.
Yeah.
Always
so it even had a better ending. There's another story that you will find from the Iditarod's own website, and it differs. It differs a little bit because in this version of events, there's a guy named Joe Reddington Sr. who's lived in Alaska, spent a lot of time using dog sled teams himself in his day-to-day work. And their story is that in 1973, Joe Reddington launched the Iditarod race as a way to preserve the culture of dog sledding, especially in Alaska.
Yeah, and that's because machines were taking over, right?
Yeah, they were in a John Henry situation there for a moment.
I think so, too, yeah. So we're talking about, they call them snow machines. I've heard a lot of people call them snow machines, but I've always in my life called them snowmobiles.
Right.
So snowmobiles are taking over, and I think we can all picture this time frame, you know, in the early 1970s, or at least you know of them. You've seen snowmobiles from that era, and they look essentially like they do now. I mean, they're a lot more sleek now, a lot more, you know, they look like a high-powered motorcycle now or something.
They're more reliable, too.
Yeah, they are. But back then, in 1973, they were finding that, yeah, we've got these machines and they can do it. And it's easier on, you know, of course, easier on the dogs. The dogs stay at home, you know, sure. Lay by the fire or whatever they do.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's faster, but they're not as reliable, not nearly as reliable as the dogs are. And they found that, you know, we've got to preserve this part of our history. It's not just for the historical aspect of it, but here's something that's going to work every time. And we know we've known it for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah. The people who were there, so far before Alaska became a U.S. territory, let alone a state, have been dog sledding. So Joe eventually gets everybody on board with this. The first Iditarod race occurs in 1973. The winner is a fellow named Dick Wilmarth. It takes him 20 days, 49 minutes, and 41 seconds. So you'll also hear... again, from Iditarod, they'll say that the Gnome Run of 25 inspired a different race called the Serum Run that Joe also started. So these events, there's a little bit of contradiction there, but everybody agrees on the following fact. The first Iditarod race, official race, was in 1973, which is maybe a little younger than I think a lot of people associate it with, yeah. Because we have to remember... we've seen all these images from the 1800s and so of dog sled teams because dog sledding had already been very well established before someone decided to make it a race.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, this is the very public version of dog sledding, of course. Dog sleds, as you said, have been used for many, many purposes for centuries before this. But to put it out in front of everybody and say, here's what we're doing. We're doing this incredible test of human endurance. I'm going to say dog endurance, too. I mean, I don't know if that's not measured often.
Dog endurance
is the word. However you want to put that. But 20 days. 20 days is what it took to make this course. And, you know, as you can imagine, as we'll get to later, that record has dropped and dropped and dropped. So it's become much faster race. People are getting a lot more competitive about the whole thing. And not that they weren't competitive before, but you know how this goes. I mean, this is our quest to the 4-minute mile thing. You know, like when everybody was trying to beat the 4-minute mile, and it was like they're shaving off, you know, just fractions of a second here and there, and finally someone broke it, and then now that's been shattered. You know, and when we talk about records being shattered, I mean, you look back to 1973 and the current record, which we'll tell you later, dramatic difference. Huge, huge difference. But it's not so much the desire to get there as fast has changed or anything like that. It's just that maybe there's some improvements in food for the animals.
Sure. Material science.
Higher energy. Material science is a big thing. I don't think aerodynamics plays into this, really. Not that much. Maybe we'll weigh in on some of these factors that we think have led to greatly reduced times.
Prize money.
We get later in this.
Nice.
Yeah, prize money is a huge kick in the butt, isn't it? Right. It makes makes you get up early in the morning and head out and try to make it to the next stop.
But, more aerodynamic turds. I don't know.
Yeah. That could be. Yeah. But you know what? You know what's maybe even. Something else that no one has ever really heard of outside of, you know, if you're an Iditarod follower, somebody who tracks them on GPS every year, and there are people that do that. There are two routes. There's one that does go through Iditarod, the actual town of Iditarod, and there's another route as well, and they run them in different years. So there's a north route and a south route. And what is it? The north route, I believe, is run in the even-numbered years.
Yep.
Okay. And that route, the total distance from what Anchorage to Nome, is somewhere around 975 miles. That's ballpark, because it changes a little bit here and there.
Yeah.
Based on current conditions, you know, if there was a rock slide or you know whatever.
Lack of snow sometimes makes them change the route.
Oh,
yeah. Yep.
Absolutely, avalanche or whatever.
Or you know, bad weather.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's a south route, and that's run on the odd number years. So in 2019, they ran on the south route, and that one's a little bit longer. It's 998 miles. And what I find most interesting, but it's what I find interesting about this is that they typically just round the mileage up to roughly about 1,000. I think, they go as far as to say 1,049 miles. And what's the significance of that, Ben?
It's because Alaska is the 49th U.S. state. So,
and in all likelihood, these guys are probably going that far or farther, really. I mean, there's got to be some variance to the trail, really. I mean, like Kurt was saying, you know, the bad weather can, a tree could fall, you have to go around, and maybe a tree is a bad example, it's a short distance around, but you have to take an alternate route around, and as long as it's allowed,
There's also this idea of distributing the impact of the race across these small villages by alternating the route, mm-hmm. because some of these places have, you know, maybe a few hundred inhabitants.
Yeah.
So this can be a big deal.
Yeah.
When folks come through.
Huge economic impact when the Iditarod goes through your town that year, right?
Yeah.
It really is, because people fly in for this. People want to come in for, you know, these package experiences that they purchase. You know, they want to ride along with somebody, or they want to, you know, stay at a certain hotel and watch the people come in, or they even get an opportunity to sign in some people that are checking in for the night.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, things like that. They offer some great perks if you want to buy into one of these package deals. But just the overall growth of, like, you know, being able to put these people up for the week or however long they're going to stay, maybe even longer, the meals that they serve. You know, people are buying clothing. They're buying souvenirs, of course.
Sure.
You know, there's all kinds of
taking
their own dog sled home. I don't know.
Oh, no, man. Can you imagine? What an amazing present.
Yeah, it's not really carry-on.
What
size.
A useless present if you don't have at least like six dogs already. But there is so much more to this story. We have decided to make this a two-part episode. So it's so weird, you guys. We just started getting to the specifics of the race, but I think the history was interesting. I learned several things that I did not know. I was barely aware of the sweepstakes until you had told us about it, Kurt. What do you say to this, guys? What if we pause our story here and we return in part two of our episode on the Iditarod, taking a closer look at the equipment, taking a look at some more stuff about the race itself, as well as, of course, the dogs. Other than Balto and Togo, we barely got to them.
I also want to mention a few of these rules, because I went through the entire rule book
yesterday. Right.
I read, it's 15 pages, and you'd think that's really boring, but this is not a boring rule book. It's interesting. I think there's some standouts here that I want to share with our audience and with you guys. I don't know. I'm sure if you even know these rules, but the equipment, too. I mean, the dog sleds themselves. There's more to the sled than you might think. It's not the simple you know, wooden structure that you think it is. There's far more to it, and they're pretty fascinating, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you can learn more. You can continue the conversation in part two of our upcoming episode, but you don't have to wait for that. Just between the four of us, Kurt, Scott, myself, and you listening, you can hop on to the internet and find us there to continue the conversation. We are on Facebook as Car Stuff. We're on Instagram or on Twitter. All the hits, all the good ones. And of course, we want to give a huge thanks to all of our regular listeners who tuned in. Scott, I don't know if you noticed, but on Facebook, Kurt and I were getting a lot of people who were starting to brew this conspiracy.
Yeah, free Scott.
Where's Scott?
Where are y'all hiding, Scott?
Well, I'm back and I'm safe. And I was in no danger. No danger. So, conspiracy theorists, you can rest easy, right?
Yeah.
All right. I guess we'll check in with you next time. And thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. Car Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.